I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food for August 19, 2014. How are you today? Really looking forward to this program today. We have some wonderful guests, so shall we get started? Great. My first guest is Ellie Lax, and she founded The Gentle Barn in Tarzana in 1999. It was a dream of hers since she was 7 years old. Animals were very healing and nurturing to her as she faced the challenges of growing up, finding herself fitting in, feeling understood, and so on. And she has a brand new book out. We're going to be talking about The Gentle Barn and the book, My Gentle Barn. Welcome to It's All About Food, Ellie.
Hi, good to be here.
I'm so glad we were able to make this work.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Yes, and, you know, I've begun reading your book, and I can't wait to finish it, but it is filled with some wonderful stories, some very touching stories, and you've been through a lot.
Yeah, this has been an incredible journey, I have to say.
Yeah, but I think, well, you know, I don't know. We all have different life experiences, but it looks like there's just been something within you that's guided you through all the things that you have experienced to make you come up, despite what you experienced, made you a beautiful person doing some really lovely things.
Thank you so much.
All right, so let's talk about My Gentle Barn. What is it about?
Well, My Gentle Barn is my memoir, and it starts in my childhood kind of explaining the things that I've gone through and why animals meant so much to me, and why the Gentle Barn was my dream since I was 7 years old, and all the things that I went through to kind of lead up to starting the Gentle Barn, and all the trials and tribulations that we've gone through just kind of keeping the Gentle Barn afloat. It's been an incredible journey, and I've overcome a lot of obstacles. And all those obstacles, even though in the moment I thought were going to destroy me, it ended up making me a stronger person and ended up at the end making the Gentle Barn a very successful organization.
You know, I always wonder, and I don't have the answers, but I always wonder, is it something in our DNA that makes us overcome obstacles, or is it something in the universe that some of us are attuned to, where we get our strength, where we get our guidance, because you, I mean, you've experienced abuse, you've experienced, the inconsistencies in religion, the things that people preach and the way, and the things that they do, and yet somehow you had this foundation, this truth about nature and animals and the good within them that drove you and helped you go on and overcome and do what you've done.
Well, you know, my view of things is I think that that's true for all of us. I think that we're all born with gifts inside of us that we're supposed to share with the world. And I think that part of being here is these struggles that we go through to help us find ourselves, help us stand strong in our dreams and our gifts and what we've brought to the world. And some of us get lost and never find ourselves in this lifetime. And some of us, like me, I consider myself very lucky because I was able to always hold on to that dream no matter how lost I was at times in my life. I was able to hold on to that dream kind of as a beacon guiding me through those dark times. And I never got completely lost. I always got found again back to my purpose and my dream and my vision. And so I consider myself very, very lucky because in the end I was able to hold on to my dream and make it happen. And I think that's true for all of us. I really do. I think we're all here to, in the end, find ourselves and live our dreams.
Yeah. Well, definitely, this book is definitely an inspirational testament to that. One little story in here I just want to mention. You can't talk about the whole book, and I want people to read it because it's really lovely. But you talk about, okay, sometimes I want to call myself a misanthrope because humanity just does so many crazy things that I don't believe. But at the same time, I want to say that I have hope that we can, as you say, discover our dreams and be who we are supposed to be. But there's one little story about this miniature cow. That was being raised. You talk about how the guy advertised it where your kids could give it bubble baths and then they slaughter it and then you ultimately heard this animal tell you when you were able to save him, you heard his name.
Mm-hmm.
I love that story because it's all about paying attention. It's all about listening. And many of us would just like not even pay attention or not even understand what that was. But I just love that whole story.
Thank you so much. You know, that cow, her name is Buddha, and
I said him, but it's her. Yeah.
Yeah, and she was our first cow, and my God, she taught me so much about life and love and living in the moment and finding who I am. And in her course of being at the Gentle Barn, she's given out 300,000 hugs. And it was very, very common for people to kneel down beside her to hug her and then just burst into tears because her energy and her love was so, so strong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was really incredible.
Okay. So, and why did you want to write this book?
God, for so many reasons. I was hoping that my story would inspire people to live their dreams and to find themselves, first of all. And also, it was an opportunity to tell the animal stories. You know, the Gentle Barn is kind of like a giant storybook where every
mm-hmm.
single animal has these incredible stories of where they've come from, what they've overcome, and the lessons about forgiveness, trust, and love that they teach me every day and that they continue to teach the at-risk kids that we work with. And I wanted their stories to be told. The animals that helped me found the Gentle Barn, the animals that taught me how to work with kids, the animals that taught me how to heal and to love and to lose and to let go, they've taught me everything that I know, and they continue to teach me. And I really wanted their story to be told as well. And I also wanted so desperately to tell in a very, very gentle way the issues that animals are facing and the opportunities for us to help them and to make kinder choices.
So you were really young when you had a dream.
Yeah.
And how did you connect the dots and decide not to eat animals?
You know, from the minute I could walk, I was always running around the woods and the lakes, and when I found animals in trouble, I would bring them home. But it wasn't until I was 11 years old that there was a chicken in my school. I don't know why she was there. And all the kids were running around making a lot of noise, and the chicken was in a little carrier, very, very, very scared. And so I've always loved animals, and I've always been able to see them if they're scared or in trouble. And so I went over to her, and I took her out of the carrier, and I held her, and I was stroking her and telling her that she's going to be okay and that she's safe and that no one would hurt her. And the principal ran in and said, you know, don't pet the chicken. We've got to get her to the slaughterhouse.
No.
She pulled her out of my arms and whisked her away.
Mm.
And I was standing there with my mouth open, feeling like I got hit by a 2x4. And I realized in that moment that chicken and rice was not a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
And, I realized chicken and rice was the same thing as chicken the animal. And I was very disturbed and very upset. And being only 11 years old, I felt powerless to go and, you know, try to help that chicken from the principal.
Yeah.
But I went home that night and I announced to my parents that I would never be eating animals again. And my parents said, oh, well, that's nice, dear. Eat your chicken soup. And I said, well, didn't you just hear me? I'm not eating animals. And they said, well, that's not an animal. It's just soup.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, that was an animal, and I'm not eating them again. At which point my parents freaked out and they thought, oh, my God, I'm going to die. I'm going to be anemic. I'm not going to grow. And I said, well, if that's true, so be it, but I am not going to eat animals again. It was very clear to me that animals were my friends, my witnesses, and my healers, and to eat them was just, it didn't make any sense to me at all.
You know, in some ways, I wonder about your parents because they challenged you all along the way, not supporting what you believed in. And you know, even if a parent doesn't want to agree with their child, there are different ways to approach any challenge. And there were so many unfortunate stories with the frozen rabbits and the frozen duck, where your parents were not at all supportive of what you were trying to do. And, you know, I just wonder, was that to make you even stronger and enable you to do what you went on to do?
Yeah, I mean, I have kind of a human perspective, and then I have a more spiritual perspective on that. My human perspective is I believe that we can't give what we didn't get. And so, you know, my parents in their childhood probably weren't supported for who they were and for
Absolutely.
Their strengths and gifts. And so because they weren't supported in childhood and they were groomed to be who their parents wanted them to be, that's all they knew how to be with me. And then my more spiritual kind of take on it is, you know, I meet many, many people from around the world that say that when they were young, they also brought animals home and they were always connected to animals and their parents supported them.
Yes.
And they grew up to become teachers and doctors and lawyers and business people. And maybe if I was supported in my childhood, it would have run its course and I would have been a teacher right now. But because I was never able to save the animals and I was never seen for who I was, that I just had to do it in adulthood. I mean, you know, you never know why things happen.
Yeah. I'm agreeing, and I never want anybody to experience difficulties or hardships or abuse, but when something wonderful comes out of it, you question, do the ends justify the means, whatever. There is a lot of pain and suffering in this world, and I wish it would all go away. Period.
I agree. Yes, I completely agree.
Yeah. Okay. So then, The Gentle Barn, how did you get the concept for that?
So when I was little, I was, you know, I kept bringing animals home, and my parents didn't want them in the house, and they would get rid of them. And so at 7 years old, my little temper tantrum to my parents was, "You'll see, when I grow up, I'll have a huge place full of animals, and I'll show the world how beautiful they are." So that was my temper tantrum. So really, The Gentle Barn's my temper tantrum. It's my I told you so. I always had this concept since I was seven that all the animals in the world that are lonely and hurt and have nowhere else to go, I'm going to bring them home, and I'm going to heal them. And then, together with the animals, we're going to invite all the lonely, hurting people of the world into The Gentle Barn, and we're going to heal them too. And that was just this little seven-year-old fantasy I had, and I could never quite let it go. But I had no idea how to start A Gentle Barn. I didn't have money or land or support, and I certainly didn't know how to run a nonprofit. And so I procrastinated for many, many years, 30 years to be exact. Mm-hmm. And then 15 years ago, I was driving down the street doing an errand, and I saw a petting zoo I'd never seen before. And there was just so many animals there and so much chaos going on in there. I just had to, you know, being nosy, I had to park my car and go in. And I'll spare you the details, but there was a lot of suffering there.
Yep. And, simple little petting barn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just could not stomach it. So I was running for the door, and blocking the door was this little old goat that looked like she was about to drop dead any second. And the longer story is in my book, but to make a very long story short, I asked the owner if I could have the goat, and she said no. And I said, "Well, I'm going to stay here till you say yes." And I stayed there for 12 days. And on the 13th day, she said, "Lady, take this goat and get out of here."
Wow.
And so I lived in a little house on a half-acre backyard, and I thought, well, I could bring a goat home. So I brought her home, and I healed her. And months later, she was bouncing around the backyard as happy as can be. Now, meanwhile, I had been calling the authorities about this petting zoo to see if they could make conditions better, and they all said the same thing. They said, "Yes, we've known about her for years. There's nothing we can do. She's connected politically." And it just broke my heart that all these animals were suffering so terribly, and nobody was listening. And so I said, well, at the very least, I have to do something. So I went back to the petting zoo, and I showed them a picture of Mary the goat and told them all the wonderful things I had done for her. And I said, "Look, I know that you have other animals that are suffering. No questions asked. I will take them off your hands." And she said, "Okay." And so she started dragging animals out of the back, broken bones, pneumonia, scared to death and dying. And I brought them all home. There were pigs and a miniature horse and goats and sheep and chickens. And I just brought them all home. And I fixed them all. And I wasn't thinking at the time that this was the gentle barn. I was just thinking, I cannot sleep at night knowing that these animals are suffering and nobody's doing anything about it.
Yep.
So I took them all home and I fixed them all. And then there was one particular morning where I looked out my window to a backyard that was now full of animals. And I said, oops. I said, I think I just started the gentle barn.
Yeah. Wow.
So that was 15 years ago, and we're about to celebrate our 15th anniversary next Sunday. We're very excited.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
It's a lovely story. You know, there are so many misfortunes in the world, and one person cannot solve them all, but we can all do our part, and you're definitely doing a great part. I was talking about with Patrice Jones last week about the unfortunate story about Green Mountain College with Bill and Lou, the oxens. I don't know if you know that story. But there was an opportunity for the university to make the right choice, and they didn't. I mean, people were offering to take these animals off their hand and do all kinds of wonderful things, and they didn't make the right choice, and they slaughtered one of them. And it was very, very horrible, sad story. But at least in this instant, you gave this woman an opportunity, and she made the right decision.
Yeah, and you know, here's the bottom line, and this is what I tell people all the time, because that's happened to us as well. We've discovered animals that were raised in a school and were going to be slaughtered, and we call and offer to take the animals, and they won't let us.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the bottom line, and this is a choice that every single solitary one of us has to make at one time in our lives. We have the choice where we're going to plant our feet. Are we going to plant our feet in the side of greed and making money and destroying the planet and slaughtering animals and destroying our bodies? Or are we going to plant our feet in the side of right and the side of peace and the side of kindness and the side of nourishing our bodies and preserving this planet? It's one or the other. And we have to make that decision. And so at the Gentle Barn, we are always trying to help people evolve to making that decision to plant our feet in the side of right and make kind decisions in what we're eating and in what we're wearing and in what we do in our daily lives. And, you know, some of us make huge, big strides in trying to give peace to the world, like starting a nonprofit and doing wonderful things. But there's so many things that each of us can make in our little daily lives. We can smile at someone when we pass them by.
Oh, what a difference that does.
Yeah.
That's a smile.
A smile, right?
I live in New York City, and nobody looks at anybody. And when you smile at someone, and it makes you feel good, too.
Yeah. Yeah. People, you know, are so shut down in our own little lives. We don't look at anybody. We don't smile at anybody. We don't talk to anybody. Just looking up, turning our eyes up, looking at them, smiling at somebody that's sitting on the sidewalk or passing us by, it can make such a difference. There are so many things that we can do in our little daily lives that we can stand on the side of right and we can give someone else some love and some encouragement, and it goes a long way.
I think that's the human struggle, really. That's the choice we're supposed to be making, and most people are afraid.
Yeah.
They're just afraid.
Yeah, I mean, not saying ignorance is bliss. It's true.
Yeah.
You know, being able to just shut out all the suffering and eat what we want, and it's bliss, but it will cost us in the end.
You know, you made a comment before about your parents, how they were only able to give what they got before, and I'm wondering, where did you get what you got to learn to do what you did?
I got it from my dog, and I got it from my parakeet, and I got it from all the animals that surrounded me in the woods.
Mm.
Those
mm-hmm.
animals were my witnesses, and they gave me the unconditional love that I can now give to the animals that we heal, and they let me know that I was okay.
Hmm. Yeah, that's what they're here for, to teach us about unconditional love, aren't they?
Yeah, there are angels. My little fantasy that I have is I imagine, like, the angels surrounding us before we're born, and they say, now look, you got to go down there, and it's going to be hard, and you're going to struggle, and it's going to be difficult, and you're going to see things that are horrible. But we're going to surround you with angels, and they're going to keep you strong as you move along.
Mm.
And so, yeah, we got to be on this planet, and we got to go through our stories. But there's always animals that will give us unconditional love and inspire us to keep going. And that was certainly true in my life.
All right. Now, you've got a few things going on at The Gentle Barn. What's the Adopting a Plant-Based Diet is Easy campaign? Now, I know plant-based diets are easy. I talk about them pretty much 24/7. I'm a broken record about plant foods, but tell us about Adopting a Plant-Based Diet is Easy.
Well, we're trying to help people make kinder choices, and we're trying to help the animals, we're trying to help the planet environmentally, and we're trying to encourage people to be healthier because as a species, we don't need to be this sick. And so we've launched what we call A Plant-Based Diet is Easy, and on our website, gentlebarn.org, we've got a plant-based diet website that people can click on, and in it, we have videos of different athletes and celebrities talking about why they chose a plant-based diet. And basically, we break it down into three choices: environmental, health, and ethical reasons for animals. And so we have celebrities and athletes talking about the different reasons why they chose a plant-based diet. And people can watch those videos and get inspired. They can also learn about how it impacts the environment and our health and animals when we do eat meat and drink dairy, and how it saves them and heals them when we adopt a plant-based diet. We also have recipes. We cook in our home, and we videotape it so people can see how easy those recipes are. We also go out to local restaurants, and we show people that no matter where you live or what restaurant you're eating at or where you go to eat, you can always find something that's plant-based. So we're really trying to show people it is so easy. And I know that it's new and intimidating for people, but if they can really embrace how incredibly easy it is to eat delicious things wherever we go, that maybe they won't be so afraid and they'll try it for themselves.
It's easier more than ever, and it's trending, and it's almost sexy now.
The plant-based diet is sexy. I agree.
Makes you look sexy, and you know it's just the right thing to do. And what about the Gentle 52 sponsorship program? What's that?
So my husband Jay, who we work at the Gentle Barn together, he came up with this wonderful program called Gentle 52, where, because we're open to the public every Sunday from 10 to 2, where people can come meet the animals and hear their stories and hug a cow and cuddle a turkey, and it's amazing. And so he came up with the Gentle 52 program, which basically is there's 52 Sundays in a year. So every Sunday that people are here, there's a new corporation or company that can sponsor that Sunday, and they come out and they give free products to the visitors, and they give gift certificates, and it's a way that we can support these wonderful, ethical, cruelty-free vegan companies that are doing such great things in the world. So it's a way that we can support them, but it's also a way for them to reach out to our visitors.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a win-win, and it's very exciting. Every Sunday, there's just a new vendor there. It's very, very exciting.
Yeah, well, the nice thing is that there are more and more of these companies. And so you're able to have this win-win situation. You know, about 30 years ago, even 10 years ago, it was harder to get these sponsors because they weren't out there. But fortunately, there's a lot of vegan entrepreneurs out there, and they're making wonderful products.
Yes, agreed.
Making it easy for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, you are located in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
And how do people find you?
So we're in Santa Clarita, which is just 30 minutes north of Los Angeles. And we have directions on our website, gentlebarn.org.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got to get there someday.
Oh, we would love to meet you.
I need some hugs from some of those guys.
Let me just tell you that hugging a cow can, oh my God, it's the best thing ever. It changes lives. My motto, which I'm going to make into a bumper sticker one day, is you can't hug a cow and have a bad day at the same time.
Yeah, well, I've looked into different cows' eyes. I'm not really an animal person. I don't have dogs or cats that live with me, but I have a strong feeling about how non-human animals really deserve to live their life to the fullest with their families and friends. And any time I can look into one of their eyes and tell them I'm not eating you or your friends, and I believe in you, and it's a powerful experience.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, well, Ellie, it was really lovely talking to you. I'm looking forward to finishing this memoir of yours. Thank you for sharing this story. And I hope to get to the Gentle Barn someday.
Yeah, we look forward to meeting you. It's such a pleasure to be here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, so I just wanted to say before we take a break and get to the second part of the show, Wednesday, August 20th, that's tomorrow, Wednesday, August 20th, I am hosting a webinar on water safety and drinking water purity. If you want to register, it's free. It's at 8 p.m., August 20th. Just go to the responsibleeatingandliving.com website, scroll down on the right side where it says Water Made Wonderful, and click here to reserve your spot now. I hope to see you then and get your questions ready about water safety. All right? Other than that, visit gentlebarn.org and see all the lovely things that are going on there. Okay, let's take a quick break. Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to the second part of It's All About Food here on August 19th, 2014. And we're going to continue this theme here of talking about wonderful people who are doing wonderful things for the planet and getting to know our fellow friends, the non-human animals out there, and giving them names and treating them the way they should be treated. And we can learn a lot from that. Kim Sterla is my next guest. She's the executive director of Animal Place and co-founded the sanctuary in 1989. She has been a central figure in the animal rights movement for 30-plus years. Sterla wrote the first law in the country that protects pre-university students unwilling to participate in animal dissections. For more than a decade, she has served as director of the Peninsula Humane Society. Kim is the resident pig whisperer, able to communicate beautifully with even the wiliest of pigs. She shares her home and life with dogs Ralph, Marty, and Sally. Hi, Kim. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Okay. It's really, I'm really happy to talk to you. And I'm sorry that in the last quarter century I haven't had an opportunity to meet you.
Well, come on up to Animal Place, and we'll give you a grand farm tour.
I know. It sounds pretty good. You co-founded that sanctuary about almost, 25 years ago.
25 years ago, We celebrated our 25th birthday this year. And, boy, have we seen the sanctuary grow from the little place that we co-founded to where it is now.
Yeah, so 1989, the world was a very different place. Especially
it
when it came to vegetarians, vegans, and how are you so smart?
Well, you know, the other co-founder was a veterinary professor. I was involved in the Humane Society work, always was involved in a lot of issues animals used in research, you know, fighting the trapping of animals for fur, working on legislation to protect students from doing dissection, requiring spaying and neutering. But you know, I had one of those aha moments when I started looking at the numbers. I think, gosh, look at the millions of animals we euthanize in shelters and those that are hunted and trapped and used in research and testing and et cetera, et cetera. And I added up all those animals, and that comes to about 1.5% of all animals killed in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It's the, 98.5% are farmed animals. It's the chickens and turkeys and cows and pigs. And I realized I needed to kind of redirect the course I was on and focus on those that really had no advocates for them.
It's something that is invisible to most of us, those big numbers, 70 billion today, land animals that we eat for food, not including what's in the water or who's
exactly
in the water, excuse me. And but at least the last quarter century, we've seen some good progress. It's never fast enough for those of us who are involved, but I guess when you look back at history, it's been a good quarter century.
I think it's been good for the availability of healthy vegan food.
Not
I don't
for
think
the animals,
seen it,
though.
No, we've really seen no improvement in the manner in which animals are raised and treated.
Yeah, I actually, there's probably more now because those people who have gotten the message it's not healthy to eat red meat, they've moved over to chicken, and as a result, many more lives have been lost. Many more little lives, precious little lives. Now, I heard about Animal Place recently. You've been in the news, and I started this half of the show talking about giving animals names, and there's one who has a name, Panda. Can you tell us that story? You know, when I first read it, I didn't realize Panda was a cow.
Panda is a cow, and he has an absolutely heartbreaking story, but one, unfortunately, isn't all that unusual. He was being raised as an FFA animal, a Future Farmers of America. So I think, as probably most folks realize, kids get involved in Future Farmers of America or 4-H. They buy an animal, they raise him or her, they bond with, they take care of. There's this trust that develops between the two. But, of course, that child is raising that animal exclusively to take to the county fair to sell him or her for how much per pound they get. And Panda had the unfortunate case of being raised by this student, and he was housed at the high school down in southern central California. And then a 23-year-old man, got into the schoolyard one evening. He doused Panda with gasoline and set him on fire. Mm-hmm. And Panda was found the following morning covered in blistering mm-hmm. burns over mm-hmm. a third of his body. We know how painful burn injuries yeah. are. And yeah. probably the humane thing to do would have maybe to put him out of his misery. But the yeah. student chose to rehabilitate him only so he could take him to the county fair mm. to sell him. Mm-hmm. And he was scheduled to be sold at the county fair last month. And his story really got a lot of attention, and people begged us. I got so many emails and phone calls asking us to please rescue him. Long story, or short story, I should say, of that is that we did get Panda. I drove down to Paso Robles, loaded him up in our stock trailer, and brought him back to Animal Place a week before he was scheduled to go to the county fair to be slaughtered.
And Panda's doing very well.
And Panda is doing very well, very well. It was really interesting to go to the home. He was at the boy's home, and the trust that this cow had in this kid, you know, for all he knew, the kid mm. was his friend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the only human that he really knew and bonded with, and he trustingly let the kid lead him into our stock trailer. He could have easily have trustingly let the kid lead him into the, you know, the auction what ring the following mm-hmm. week. But it's that ultimate betrayal. You know, I always think, gosh, what's the best quality I would want to instill in children? And it would really be compassion and empathy. And here with this 4-H and FFA, we're encouraging the kids to bond with these animals. They take care of them. They nurture them. And yet only really to do the ultimate betrayal, to sell them at auction when they're, you know, 6 to 9 months of age.
I often wonder why the world is as violent as it is. And the news lately, it's always horrible, but there seems to be mm-hmm. some really horrible things going on all over.
Yes.
In other countries and in our country as well. And I keep asking myself, how do humans do these things? And one of the answers that come back to me is we all have violence in our own lives, and we teach children violence and to accept it, and then the rest happens.
Exactly. I mean, rather than to nurture this, I mean, how many kids do you see on the front page of your local paper at county fair and they're crying as their pig's going to market? Boy, you have a child that's bonding with an animal and has empathy and compassion. You want to nurture that quality.
Yeah.
You don't want to squelch it. You don't want to stamp on it, but you want it to blossom even more. So, yeah, Panda's here, and Panda now has a girlfriend, I'm happy to tell you.
Oh, that's nice.
We rescued another little 4-year-old Jersey cow who had been rescued from actually a veal crate operation, and he's quite enamored with her. So Panda and Jazzy, as her name, are good buddies, and then slowly they'll be introduced to the big cow herd we have here at the sanctuary.
These groups, Future Farmers of America and 4-H, I just sigh thinking about it, but there needs to be things that we can do about about this, about raising children in this way. Back in March, I spoke to 250 cattle ranchers about climate change and animal agriculture's contribution, mm-hmm. and there were some young children at this event that had raised some animals, and they were giving them prizes, and mm-hmm. the same thing, they were going off to slaughter, and mm-hmm. yet they were being rewarded for the work that mm-hmm. they had done.
It's interesting. I've gone to the county fairs many a time, and I'll walk around the barns and I'll talk to the kids just kind of off record. Hey, what's the name of your pig? And, oh, you know, how long have you had her? And you're taking her into the ring. And then I'll just say, hey, is this kind of tough on you? And I would say half the children I've spoken to, and I've spoken to so many, they voluntarily say it was the first time.
Mm.
And that is so telling. You know, that is the desensitization process happening right there. It was the first time, but it's easier. And then they go into a justification mode of, well, you know, I'm going to be able to buy a car with this money, or it's going to help me go to school. So it's really interesting to see the pattern of the replies I get from the children when I'm talking
yeah.
to them about it.
Yeah, and then when we're grown up, we justify all kinds of actions
exactly
that are based on experiences like that.
Exactly.
Okay, well, happy ending for Panda.
Happy ending for Panda.
Happy beginning for Panda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whisper.
Now, are you really a pig whisperer?
I have to say, I think I am. I I do have an affinity for pigs, and I have, oh my goodness, I can't even begin to tell you how many over the 25 years that I've been able, had the honor of rescuing and living with, and yeah, there's something about pigs that I love. I think
I want to know what they told you.
Well, you know, that's that independent nature of them. They're very indulgent. They love food. They kind of have similar taste buds to humans in that, you know, offer them a head of broccoli or a nice juicy apple or cantaloupe, and they're going to go for the juicy cantaloupe or apple. Or if you want to put in a pastry, they'll take the pastry over some healthy fruit or vegetable.
Okay, I would always choose broccoli, but I'm not.
Well, then, I don't know what to say. they would probably choose broccoli if it was, you know, steamed and sautéed in a little margarine and garlic. They're just very engaging animals. They come up to you like dogs do, but then again, they have that aloofness that cats have. Mm. So I find them as a real combination of that. Those are two species that so many people can relate to, the cats and dogs. They've been so maligned, and I think that increases my empathy for them. They're incredibly bright. And, you know, and I can't forget that they're just so big. You just have one huge animal that you can just hug.
Now, 25 years at Animal Place, what have been some of the highlights?
Dolly, I think any time we embark on a large rescue, that is a highlight for me. And I'm grateful we've been able to do so many. I was there at Katrina and, you know, scooping up a couple of thousand birds who were just scattered all over broiler farms. We've done a lot of chickens raised in the battery cage, those that are, you know, come from the egg-laying industry.
Yep, deep.
So these are chickens. Yeah, their whole life has been just crammed in a cage. That's all they know. They've never perched. They've never felt sunlight on them. They've never dust bathed. They've never done anything, not even stretched their wings. And we have, oh, my goodness gracious, we've saved well over 10,000 of them over these past 4 years.
Mm.
So to pull them out of the cages and then transport them back to the sanctuary and take them out of the transport crates and put them on the ground and watch them literally spread their wings for the first time, little old flap, that never gets old. I mean, that just never gets old. So I think it's those moments when you're able to liberate, you know, a large number of lives, and then they eventually they get placed into wonderful new forever homes. So,
but, you know, these birds have been born in the factories, and
yes.
How do they know what to do when they're where they're supposed to be on dirt
and
amongst the greenery? Yeah, many of them don't.
They don't. I mean, I think that's the real interesting thing. It's, there is a rehabilitation process. There's a good month they're with us before they're placed into homes. Surprisingly, however, there will always be that first one or two that even on the day of the rescue, they feel sunshine on them for the first time, and they actually stretch out and take a sun bath.
Mm.
And then in a few days, some of them will start taking dust baths, and the others will learn from them. It takes them a while to perch because they suffer from osteoporosis. Their muscles have atrophied, of course, because they're not even able to move. So they have to build up their strength. And it is a learning process. But to see them explore their new world, it's just, it's heartwarming. It's joyful. It's, you know, it's what this work's all about.
I'm on your website, animalplace.org, and I'm watching the little counter on the right-hand side, as how many animals have been slaughtered as long as this page has been opened. The numbers are always so mind-boggling. You know, I said 70 billion before. You say 140 billion animals. I guess you're including sea animal, marine animals in here. It just doubles the number. Ding! And it's just incomprehensible.
You know, it is. We're in the process of constructing our Museum of Animal Farming here at the sanctuary, and it's going to be an interactive museum. And we're trying to think of ways to illustrate the numbers. And so if we just look at the United States, you know, the number is about 10 billion land animals killed a year. That's just the United States. Now, most of those are chickens raised for their flesh. And it ends up being actually per second in the United States, about 264 just chickens each second. So each second. And you almost have to bring it back down to some one of those small numbers because I can't fathom what 10 billion is. Nobody can.
No. 264 a second.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it's just, those are the numbers, and that's just chickens, and that's just in the United States. So, you know, we certainly have our work cut out for us. The sanctuary isn't all we do. It can't be all we do. We have to focus so much on preventative programs. It's just essential that we educate as many people as we can.
Right. And so what do you do? What are some of those programs?
Well, you know, I think one of my favorite programs, and perhaps it's because I began my career in the animal shelter world, is our Food for Thought program, which is to invite, to ask SPCAs and humane societies to adopt a vegetarian policy for their events. So if they're going to have a fundraiser to help the dogs, it makes no sense to be frying cows on the grill.
What's their reaction to that?
We have, gosh, we started this program probably 15 years ago, and we've just kind of rejuvenated it this past year. There hasn't been a whole lot of progress, I would say, since I was working in shelters 25 years ago. Most do not have a vegan or vegetarian policy. That said, several are adopting, and we even have a cash reward of $250 should they adopt one, just as a little incentive and a thank you. And we just presented the award to, what was the name of the shelter back in New Jersey? St. Hubert's, is it? And they just adopted Tony LaRusse's shelter in Walnut Creek, California. They adopted. So, you know, it's happening. But the thing is, you know, here are all these shelters. They're in such a wonderful position for role modeling.
Absolutely.
A compassionate diet.
It's not just shelters, unfortunately. It's this human thing where we have the blinders on. I know it's frustrating at these sort of events that they're serving animals when they're trying to save and protect animals. But when I go to events like cancer research events or things about illnesses and they're serving junk food and animal products and things that we know promote the disease, you know, I don't think you'd see cigarettes or cigars offered at a lung cancer
convention. I couldn't agree more. That is the analogy I've used so much. I absolutely agree with you.
Somehow we got that one. But everything, you know, when it comes to food, we have such a long way to go.
We have such a long way to go. And it's interesting. In some ways, it seems a little overwhelming. But the beauty of this issue is it is so empowering because there is mm-hmm. something every single person can do all day long to help.
Say that again.
Just think, if everyone gave up eating meat and animal products in just one of their dishes for that day, and then slowly got on that path and increased the number of vegan meals that they were having, that would just be terrific. So it is an incredibly empowering issue. And I think part of our responsibility, those of us working on behalf of animals, is to give folks the tools. So we have a Sanctuary Sweets e-news that we send to people with delicious recipes every week. And we do vegan cooking classes. We've got to show people that it's really so darn easy nowadays to switch over to a healthier and far more humane diet.
Absolutely. It is easier. So what are you feeding your animals?
Well, my dogs are vegan. They have been for, gosh, this has been decades.
Mm-hmm.
And the food we eat, it's a commercially prepared bee dog, but there's several really good, high-quality dog brand dog food. And then I also supplement their food with I make a big dish of rice and barley, and I put carrots and yams in there, and I boil it all up and then freeze it. So they get that with their dry food so that they get a lot of pretty good healthy diet.
Mm-hmm. And then the animals that you've rescued.
The animals we've rescued, well, we have our local grocery store and has for years donates the day-old produce to us. So the rabbits and the chickens and the pigs and those that want it get some delicious fruits and veggies. The cows, we have 600 acres here at Animal Place, and so we're so fortunate in that most of the animals can just do free graze.
Mm.
We have to supplement it with grass hay, and you know, they get their treats too, some grain, but very little because it's fattening. But our animals are all on, you know, just dozens and dozens and dozens of acres. And so they're able to go for free graze and have a very natural diet for their species.
Yeah, that's so lovely. And you know what? The answer, obviously, is to go vegan. It's the answer to everything. And as I mentioned before, when I visited these cattle ranchers, I was on this feedlot seeing hundreds of cows fenced in sitting on dirt. And it is just this incredibly unnatural thing. And unfortunately, you may have heard this, that those that are interested in, quote, humane slaughter because they're concerned about animal welfare, they don't realize that it's worse on the environment to graze animals. And, I mean, the ideal thing is to just stop eating them, and we can have a nice population of a variety of animals living naturally and in balance with the environment.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, having free-range or grass-fed beef, as they say, that's not sustainable. It's marketed as sustainable, but it's maybe sustainable for, you know, the 1% of the population that could afford it. It's not going to feed the world as this mass production of animals are.
And then you've heard this so many times where people say, but we need these animals. We need them for manure for our crops. And, okay, there's veganics now, so we know that we don't need animal manure. But even if you wanted to use animal manure, you could have animals. Why do you have to kill them?
Exactly. And actually, you're right. We had a huge veganic farm here of 3 acres, and we grew all sorts of produce. And we did it as a model just to see, okay, we won't use our manure. Now, ours is kind of, you know, cruelty-free manure, but we won't do it. We'll just see if we can do it veganically. And it was couldn't have been more successful. We had CSA boxes. We sold that whole season. So, yes, we do not need animal manure to be fertilizing our crops, and it is doing just, if you haven't already, I don't know if you've had the opportunity to see that excellent film that came out, Cowspiracy.
I haven't seen it yet. I've talked to the directors.
God.
Yeah.
That's a game changer. I'm hoping that's a real game changer. It really does an excellent job of making the case for the impact that animal ag is having on our environment. And where the heck is the environmental community on
this? Oh, please. They've never been there. It's all about
they've
hypocrisy.
They've never been there.
Yeah. They've never been there.
I know.
Oh. All right, let's 25 years have gone by, and I don't know how long you've been vegan.
Oh, golly, more than that. 30-some-odd years.
So I don't know how you are in the kitchen, but what are some of the things you're eating now that you like to eat, and has it changed over the last quarter century?
You know, I am not nuts about the faux meats. I'll try them once in a while, but I think all of us who work at Animal Place, we would consider ourselves foodies, so we do potlucks all the time. And for me, I can't get happier than a big plate of pasta smothered in garlicky olive oil with veggies on top. I mean, that I'm a happy camper with that. And Mexican food, I could eat all day long.
Yep.
So, yeah, I kind of go for the carbs, the fattening stuff. Maybe that's because we're working
Yeah, you're probably working it off quite a bit. Yeah, I love food. And don't we, I don't know if anybody's done a survey, but I think the percentage of vegans are more, there's probably a higher percentage of foodies in vegans than there are foodies in the general population.
You know, you might be right. I hadn't thought about that, but you really may be right.
I haven't thought about it until this moment, but now I'm thinking that would be a fun survey to do because
that would.
I mean, we really do love food, and that's one of the ironies, because people that think they can't go vegan think they're going to miss things, they think they're going to be deprived, and then, you know, they should just look at this mob of crazy happy people eating vegan food. We love our food.
Well, you could. I absolutely agree with you, and I think that's one of the responsibilities those of us who are vegan have, is to cook for our friends and our colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bring one of your delicious vegan cakes or vegan chocolate tofu pie, or make them. Oh, I have a great recipe for cashew cheese lasagna that I have served to so many omnivores, and they love it. And so it's really, I think, incumbent upon us to do some cooking for our omnivore friends. And that really is, that speaks for itself. They know that you can eat, you know, vegan and tasty.
Absolutely. Yes. I'm thinking when people get frustrated about the world today and all the violence that's going on and feeling frustrated and all they want to do is post things on Facebook and share articles about how horrible things are, I think they should make a vegan meal and invite all their friends.
I love it.
That's something to do that will take the violence out of their life. Whoa. Okay.
That's a great idea.
Kim, you're awesome.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thank you. My pleasure. Great pleasure.
Everybody should visit animalplace.org.
Yes, please do.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Just a couple minutes left. I wanted to remind you again about tomorrow's free webinar on water purity. You can sign up at my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. It's over on the right-hand side. Please join me tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Free water webinar, and you can ask questions. It'll be a lot of fun. Also, we're going through our summer fundraising drive here at Responsible Eating and Living, and if you like what we do, please support us because we could use your help. Again, you can visit the website and hit the donate bar. And that's all. So I recommend everybody making vegan meals and inviting your friends over and enjoying those foods and letting people know that plant foods taste great. And that's how we can become a kinder, gentle world faster. All right, that's your assignment. So have a delicious week. Bye-bye.